So my name is Reverend Enya, if you don't know who I am. And I'm offering the merits of sharing the Dharma today with Daiji, my Dharma brother. Also the clemency hearing, the governor of Oklahoma, his name is Kevin Stitz, the parole and pardon board, Jack and Paul, who are Daiji's attorneys, and his good friend Lynn. Daiji's clemency hearing is June 17th, and his pending execution date is June 27th. So may all the Buddhists and ancestors continue to assist us in our practice today. So I'd like to share with you today a handful of expedient means given to us by the Buddha. And all of you who know me know how fond I am of the Jataka tales. So we're going to start there today. And the Jataka tales are stories of the Buddha's previous lives. And he just takes various forms, whether it be an animal, a human, being a king, or an outcast. He takes all sorts of different forms. But what happens in the Jataka tales is that they tell the story of how the Buddha exhibits some virtue, whether it be practicing the paramitas, whether it's exhibiting the teachings of the Four Noble Truths. There's a very virtuous teaching in all of the stories. So today's Jataka tale is a blend of true translations with a little dash of artistic licensing to make it a little more understandable. And the tradition says that two friends were in Savatthi, one who joined the brotherhood and now was an elder monk, and the other was a lay disciple. Every day, the elder monk would go to the disciple's house, where his friends used to give him an alms of food and then make a meal for himself, and then accompany him back to the monastery, where they sat talking all the livelong day, till the sun went down. When the lay disciple went back to town, his friend, the elder monk, went with him to escort him on his homeward way, going so far as the city gates before turning back to the monastery. The intimacy of these two became known among the brethren, who were sitting one day in the Hall of Truth, talking about the intimacy which existed between the pair, when the master, the Buddha, entered the hall and asked what was the subject of their talk, and the brethren told them. The master then said, "Not only now, brethren, are these two intimate with one another, they were intimate in bygone days as well." And so saying, the Buddha told the story of the past. So once upon a time, there was a royal bull elephant who was very well fed and cared for. In the neighborhood of the elephant shed, there was a scrawny, poorly fed, and stray dog. She was attracted by the smell of the rich, sweet rice being fed to the royal elephant. So she began sneaking into the shed and eating the wonderful rice that fell from the elephant's mouth. She liked it so much that soon she would eat nowhere else. While enjoying her food, the big, mighty elephant did not notice the tiny, shy, stray dog. By eating such rich food, the once underfed dog gradually became bigger, stronger, and very handsome looking. The good-natured elephant began to notice her. Since the dog had gotten used to being around the elephant, she had lost her fear. So she did not bark at him. Because he was not annoyed by the friendly dog, the elephant gradually got used to her. Slowly they became friendlier and friendlier with each other. Before long, neither would eat without the other, and they enjoyed spending their time together. When they played, the dog would grab the elephant's heavy trunk, and the elephant would swing her forwards and backwards from side to side, up and down, and even in circles. So they became best friends and never wanted to be separated. And just in case you're interested, this is a picture of the best friends, the elephant and a little bodhisattva dog. They look familiar to me. Then one day, a man from the village, a remote village, who was visiting the city, passed by the elephant shed. He saw the frisky dog, who had become strong and beautiful. He bought her from the mahout, who was the elephant caretaker, who had become, even though the mahout really didn't own her. So of course the royal bull elephant became very sad, since he missed his best friend, the dog. He became so sad that he didn't want to do anything, not to eat, not drink, not even bathe. So the mahout had to report to the king that his elephant was sick, although he said nothing about selling the friendly dog. So it just so happened the king had a very intelligent minister who was known to understand animals. So he told the minister to go find out the reason of the elephant's condition. The wise minister went to the elephant shed, and he saw immediately that the royal bull elephant was very sad. And he thought, this once happy elephant does not appear to be sick in any way. But I have seen this condition before in men and in animals. I believe this condition is grief-stricken, probably due to the loss of a very dear friend. Then he said to the guards and the attendants, I find no sickness. Our dear elephant seems to be grief-stricken due to the loss of a friend. Do you know if this elephant has a very close friendship with anyone? They told him how the royal elephant and the stray dog were best friends. What happened to the stray dog? The minister asked. He was taken by an unknown man, they replied, and we do not know where he is now. Not so good, huh? The minister returned to the king and said, Your Majesty, I am happy to say your elephant is not sick. As strange as it may sound, he became best friends with the stray dog. Since the dog has been taken away, the elephant is grief-stricken and does not feel like eating, drinking, or bathing. This is my opinion. Then the king said, Friendship is one of life's most wonderful things. My minister, how can we bring back my elephant's friend and make him happy again? My lord, replied the minister, I suggest we make an official announcement that whoever has the dog who used to live at the royal elephant shed will be fined. This was done, and when the villager heard of the fine, he released the dog immediately. She was filled with great happiness and ran as fast as she could straight back to her best friend, the royal bull elephant. The elephant was so overjoyed that he picked up his friend with his trunk and sat her on top of his head. The happy dog wagged her tail while the elephant's eyes sparkled with delight. They both lived happily ever after. Meanwhile, the king was very pleased with the elephant's full recovery, and he was amazed that his minister seemed to be able to read the mind of an elephant. So thus the master who started the story, the Buddha, concluded his telling of the story about the two who were intimate in bygone days, as well as today's date. He showed the connection. The lay disciple was the beautiful dog of the past. The aged elder was the elephant. And the Buddha said, I myself was the wise minister. Huh? I just appreciate this so much. That's a long-reaching perspective, that the Buddha was telling a tale about himself as a wise minister in a previous life and about the awesome friendship between the royal bull elephant and the beautiful dog and the elder monk and the lay disciple. It's true. Things may not be what you think or what they appear to be. I just find that just blows my mind to think of that perspective. It's very long-reaching. Okay, so for me, the best way to bridge what I think is happening with what is actually happening is to be quiet. Take a moment to listen and take one giant step backwards. In other words, to give myself a little space. We always have access to the beginner's mind, one with open and unlimited possibilities. As I pay more attention to the present moment, I find that often I jump to conclusions based on old thoughts, or perhaps just grabbing a conclusion out of the thin air. Our entire being, everything, is about relationships filled with impermanence. Yes, we are all the same Buddha nature. Everything is possible. Nothing is in contradiction. And every mind, every being, and everyone sees his own world, a world unlike anyone else's. We can only see and understand the Buddha in the context of what we sense and know. I find it invaluable when my mind is quiet and still. It is here that things unfold naturally. If I catch myself mid-stride of being judgmental, for example, as soon as I'm aware of this attitude, I know it is time to recalibrate and reset. Look inwards. And this refresh, this pause, this taking a space, reinforces the ability to return to the beginner's mind. This in itself is encouraging and reinforcing. If you can do it once, you can do it again. So on one occasion, the Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, came to the Buddha and said, in his view, half the spiritual life revolves around spiritual friendship. The Buddha immediately corrected him and said, Do not say this, Ananda. Spiritual friendship is not half of the spiritual life. It is the entire spiritual life. So here's a few thoughts written by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi in 2008 on spiritual friendship, which I really appreciate. People new to Buddhism often take the Dharma to be purely an individual path of spiritual development. They imagine that the only correct way to follow the Dharma is to lock oneself up in one's room, turn off the lights, and devote all one's effort to practicing meditation. However, if we look at the Buddhist text, we would see that Buddha again and again stressed the value of spiritual friendship as support for the Buddhist path throughout the entire course of its practice. As I mentioned, Venerable Ananda came to the Buddha and said that in his view, half of the spiritual life revolves around the spiritual friendship. The Buddha immediately corrected him and said, don't say this, Ananda. It is the entire spiritual life. But this is the sentence that I don't always hear with this particular story. Then the Buddha said, with reference to himself, in this whole world, I am the supreme spiritual friend of all living beings. Because it is dependence upon me, by relying upon me, by those who are subject to birth, old age, and death, become liberated from birth, old age, and death. It seems to me we all know that once you're born, that you're going to die. It's really easy to forget that somehow. If we live long enough, however, we experience sickness, old age, disease, and death. This is a given. And as we cultivate an already existing relationship with our Buddha nature, the unborn, there is an aha light that comes on, at least off and on maybe. And we find our way and we integrate into the dualistic samsara world in which we live. We find our refuge in our supreme spiritual friend, the Buddha, and rely on the Tathagata's merit. It is here our bodhisattva vow solidifies our practice, our relationship with all things, as we practice the four immeasurables of compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So Bhikkhu Bodhi continues that he wanted to make a distinction between two types of spiritual friendship, one which he called horizontal, the other vertical. And he calls the horizontal spiritual friendship is a friendship between people who are roughly the same level in following the path. This is the friendship between partners in following the path. And what unites them as spiritual friends is a common dedication to following the Buddhist path. People come together and unite as friends for various reasons. We usually take the gregarious side of human nature for granted. But to understand the nature and the importance of friendship, it's instructive to reflect on the factors that bring people together and unite them as friends. To do so will give us a standard for evaluating our own friendships and seeing if they are helpful or harmful. The Buddha says that it is because an element that people come together and unite. And what is meant by this element? It's the basic disposition or a trait or character. Thus, the Buddha says that those of inferior dispositions come together and unite with those of inferior dispositions, whereas those of superior dispositions come together and unite. So if we cast our mental eye out upon the world, we can see that on any given Saturday night, many people will go out to nightclubs to enjoy themselves dancing. Others may go to bars to enjoy drinking and chatting. Others might go to sport matches. Others will get together and watch crude films. This is what unites them in friendship. So this is how people of inferior disposition come together and unite. So Bhikkhu Bodhi continues by saying, but others come together to listen to Dharma talks, participate in meditation retreats, and study the Dharma. In this case, what unites them is a shared dedication to the Dharma. So the defining characteristic of spiritual friendship is dedication to a common teaching, in this case, the Buddha's teaching. This is dedication to a common teaching, dedication to the practice of the same path, dedication in similar practices, similar ideals and aspirations, and a unity based on the engagement of the practice. It is uniting with others in common dedication that we strengthen and uplift the effect of our own practice. When we try to practice the path alone, we may feel as though we are walking through a desert. Now, I happen to like the desert. It's very beautiful. And I think what he is saying here, it can be very lonesome. The landscape around us is rough and barren, and we have no refreshment, no inspiration from others to replenish our energies. But when we unite with others in spiritual friendship based upon common aspirations, this reinforces our own energies. When we walk a common path and engage in common practices, we gain encouragement, strength, and inspiration to continue our practice. This is like crossing the desert in a caravan. Others help us to carry the supplies. We can pause for conversation. We have a sense of sharing the trials along the way, and we rejoice together as we approach our destination. So I like the fact that Bhikkhu Bodhi is guiding us to consider that it's not about satisfying ourselves. Rather, we are concerned with the other person, not because of the way that that person satisfies us, but because we want to see the other person grow and develop in the direction of greater wisdom, of greater virtue, of greater understanding. We want the other person's wholesome qualities to attain maturity and bring forth fruits for the benefit of others. This is the essence of horizontal friendship, a keen interest in helping our friends grow and develop in the practice of the Dharma, in maturing their potential for goodness, for understanding, for wholesomeness. Not about satisfying ourselves, rather cultivating a keen interest to help our friends spiritually. So he also spoke about vertical friendship, which is more about the bond between a junior and a senior, or a teacher and a student, which is a very important relationship. And I think we'll leave that discussion for another day. So it's clear that taking refuge in the Buddha, taking refuge in the Dharma, taking refuge in the Sangha is essential and are at the core of our practice, along with our meditation as our steady, faithful companion. So I'd like to talk just a little bit about beginner's mind. And there was a great book written back in 1970 by Shinrin Suzuki called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which is very, very popular to this day. It's a treasure. And the book refers to Zen mind as the entire succession, historical, mythical, of all the teachers, the patriarchs, monks, and lay practitioners from the Buddhist time to today. This is all accessible to us, and we are part of that. Beginner's mind is an encouragement to realize our own true nature. This is the mind that has been passed down to us continuously through the Buddhas and the ancestors. The mind of the beginner is empty, and the innocence of the first inquiry is needed throughout the practice, your entire lifetime, lifetime after lifetime. And the next one. It is essential that we are ready to doubt, to be open, to accept to all the possibilities, to maintain the kind of mind that sees things as they are through your meditation and in your life. Talking about the beginner's mind, for me, a picture comes of a hike I took long ago approaching the beginning of a climb in Takeets, which is a climbing area in the San Gabriel Mountains in Southern California. I very vividly remember I am simply wide open, scrambling up a granite approach with full attention on everything and being present and exhilarating, and every step was a discovery. Well, I like to hold the same vision for my practice today, fresh every day, every night. And I have to say, I will readily admit that sometimes it takes a little more patience and effort when I'm tired or when I'm crabby. That exhilaration is not quite the same when I'm eating a lot of humble pie during the day. And it's still equally as helpful to point me inwards, which is the point. Either way, it's worth the extra effort to keep an even mind, steady, bright, and diligent. So our practice is a direct expression of our true nature. So let your confidence in your Buddha nature beam out across the universe. Make your own way with effort, and you will help others. Take the time to emphasize the importance to the approach to every moment with your beginner's mind, free from a position or a preconceived notion. So for me right now, the beginner's mind is a starting point, the place where I depart from and return to. And there is a distance between the departure and the returning. It's similar to like putting your hand in the river. You're unable to put your hand in the same river twice. That's how fast things are moving. Still, you're coming back and returning, departing, returning to the same place. So the distance is actually a process. And with the process, there are insights and realizations, and there will be learning and letting go, especially with different states of mind, which we all have. So in the words of a good spiritual friend of mine, the starting point and the end point, it is the great path of turning from evil to good, from delusion to awakening, from the ordinary to the holy. It is also a path of transforming from selfishness to benefiting oneself and others. It is the path of a bodhisattva. Now, I wrote this before where Master Kinue appeared here, but I love this, and I'm going to leave it in here. He wrote some time ago, I believe, that the purpose of serene reflection, Soto Zen, meditation, is to come to know and live from the unborn, the Buddha nature within ourselves and all things. All of us have an intuitive knowledge of the Buddha nature. Therefore, meditation is not a means to an end, but rather a harmonization of oneself with the source of compassion, love, and wisdom. So for me, Reverend Master Kinue was pointing us back to the beginner's mind with that sentence, and I really appreciate it. So impermanence continues to be relentless in my life, maybe yours too. And maybe it's just because I'm paying more attention to the process and the flux, but it's just like it's a state of constant combustion. It's the mere giving action of how you breathe. That's a combustion reaction that goes on all the time. I'm breathing all the time, but it's interesting how I notice it sometimes. Generally, it goes on unnoticed. I'll just say that. So the best example of what I'm trying to get to here for me right now is that of being a candle. When we light a candle, the flame appears continuous. The word flame applies to what we see during the entire time the candle is lit. The burning wax, the wick, and oxygen are all different in each and every moment of its existence. Therefore, the flame is different in each and every moment too. Like the candle, we are constantly assimilating nutrition, eliminating waste, and breathing air to keep our fires alive. If short of oxygen, our fires smolder inefficiently, radically decreasing the quality of our lives. If the air supply is totally cut off, our flames quickly expire and our bodies die. So right now, I am a candle, brightly dancing and flaming. Then I'm a candle melted down to the basic molecules of wax, wick, and a small gasping flame, reborn as a candle burning at both ends. The flame hot and the wind gusty. I'm a pool of molecules with a glimmering of fire, which is suddenly refreshed. The candle upright stands with a gentle flicker of the eternal within. This gentle flame is always lit, and for me is trust in action, the divine light which fills this empty vessel. I'm so grateful for that. This empty vessel is a candle of impermanence, which is actually the glue that holds things together while simultaneously constantly changes. Impermanence supports the interconnectedness of spiritual friendship and the direct cultivation of the beginner's mind. So I'd just like to add one more component of the Buddha's expedient means today, and that is adversity. And it turns out that adversity is a very good friend of impermanence, from my experience. And the setbacks in adversity are not obstacles in the way of life. Rather, it is a catalyst that can make us humble and mature. If a royal, huge bull, elephant, and a scraggly, shy dog can get used to one another, losing their fear and reactive habits, so we too can become friendlier and friendlier with others, even enjoying spending time together with our dedication to the common practice of the Dharma. In the outline of the practice by Bodhidharma, translated by Red Pine, he begins by saying, to enter the practice refers to four all-inclusive practices. So I'm not going to read the whole outline of the practice. It's a very short, wonderful, I've had this for a long time and it's really helped me. But it talks about Bodhidharma's outline of the practice, which if anyone at the end of the day here wants to take a copy with them, they're to the right of the exit door. So I'll just read the first one, which has to do with adversity. It's called Suffering and Justice. The other ones are Adapting to Conditions, Seeking Nothing, and Practicing the Dharma. So suffering and justice. When those who search for the path encounter adversity, they should think to themselves. In countless ages gone by, I've turned from the essential to the trivial and wandered through all manners of existence, often angry without cause and guilty of numberless transgressions. Now that I do no wrong, I'm punished by my past. Neither gods nor men can foresee when an evil deed will bear its fruit. I accept it with an open heart and without complaint of injustice. The sutras say, when you meet with adversity, don't be upset because it makes sense. With such understanding, you are in harmony with reason, and by suffering injustice, you enter the path. So whether you like it or not, suffering and injustice will happen. That's my experience anyway. And whether we benefit or not depends on if we can understand the value of adversity. It is because we have encountered unfair treatment we will understand the value of justice. There's nothing like the sting of betrayal to help us truly understand and appreciate the importance of loyalty. When we experience and truly allow ourselves to be lonely, in this way we will not take good spiritual friends for granted. I'm coming down on the home stretch here, so bear with me. So the last thing, this handout is also by the door if anyone would like one when you leave. And I'm very fond of it. It's so helpful. And I keep it nearby so that when I'm upset or in pain, which this recommends that you read, that you can refer to it. But it's called the 10-point contemplation on things dear as a king's ransom to ordinary people, or the 10 points obstructing samadhi. And the release of these 10 factors are to facilitate the access to samadhi. So here they are. Number one, do not hope for a disease-free body, in whose body there is no injuries, no sickness, no disease. The force, I better do this. Thank you. In whose body there is no injury, no sickness, no disease, the force of greed and desire arise and take hold. Thus the sage counsels, treat all injury, illness, and disease of body as good medicine. Number two, do not hope for a life free from difficulties and trouble in this world. If life in this world is free from troubles, one's mentality becomes arrogant and conceited, and one's tendencies luxurious and extravagant. Thus the sages counsel, to truly live in the world, you must make it through the anxiety and worry, through the difficulty and the despair. Number three, if you would study the way, do not hope for obstacles not to arise. In one whose life has no obstacles nor hindrances, all that they study cannot be absorbed, but is sloughed off and runs away. Thus the sages counsel, it is in the very penetration of the barrier that liberation is realized. Number four, in your cultivation, do not hope that you will not encounter Mara. In the path of cultivation, one's resolution cannot become absolutely firm, strong, and steady without facing the devil. Thus the sages counsel, in your cultivation, consider the devil and all evil influences your dearest of friends, most helpful of loyal companions. Number five, do not hope for or contrive plans or schedules to complete your practice easily. If you feel your practice is easily completed, it means you have been hasty, rash, precipitous. Thus the sages counsel, it is through undergoing and experiencing every sort of fear, terror, and dread that our practice reaches fulfillment. Number six, in making friends and acquaintances, do not hope to gain anything. If you associate with people hoping to get something from them, it will only lead to you being hurt, disappointed, and ultimately cynical. Thus the sages counsel, associate with integrity and fidelity. Number seven, do not hold out hope that others will submit to your ideas and wants obediently. If others obediently acquiesce to your wants or ideas, you will naturally become arrogant, proud, and spoiled. Thus the sages counsel, nourished by the grace of those who do not agree with your ideas and wishes, cultivate your forest garden. Number eight, in virtuous and benevolent endeavors, do not hope for reward or for the fruits of your labors. In hoping for reward, it is this scheming intention that verily takes it away and makes it other. Thus the sages counsel, throw away accumulated favors as definitely as an utterly decrepit, worn-out partner of what was once a pair of shoes. Number nine, do not hope your cup will runneth over with wealth or status. If your cup does overflow with wealth and status, you become giddy and you will be lost in arrogance among the fools. Thus the sages counsel, be wealthy, happy, generous with the smallest of fortunes. And the last one, number 10, do not under any circumstance feel you have been unfairly victimized and hold out hope that the proper authorities or those concerned will redeem you by shedding light on or clearing up the situation. If you seem to be an innocent victim of circumstance, will a mind full of ill will and resentment really help you or to become enlightened and clear? Thus the sages counsel, you must as the major party concerned in preventing undue suffering, adopt a proper authority and clear yourself through the cultivation of the path. So moment by moment, devote yourself to your practice. The truth is always near at hand, within your reach. Knowing to be content is helping us embrace the Buddha's teaching so that we create a wholesome spiritual relationship with ourselves and all things. And I highly recommend incorporating the four immeasurables: compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, any time and any way that you can in your daily life. How utterly fortunate we are to be here today at the foot of Mount Shasta, practicing here at the Abbey all together. We will continue to practice together regardless of the distance, sharing the same moon, returning to the beginner's mind. We share our hearts in peace and harmony. It is like shooting an arrow into the ground. You just can't miss.